Taking a look at fall bird migration on the program right now. Thanks for joining us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bill Volker. He is a retired wildlife educator, naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh State Wildlife Area for 27 years and has been watching birds for 50 years and has sighted more than 3,900 species of birds. And so he knows a lot. You may have, you've been listening for a while, you may have heard him in the past. He does a wonderful job. And as you listen, I hope you'll join in. Which birds have you noticed in the process of migrating, for example? Have some left your area for the year? Or let us know which birds you need help identifying. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or email to talk@WPR.org. And Bill, great to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Larry. It's always a pleasure to be here.
So, what have you been? What birds have you been seeing recently?
Well, the songbirds are really on the move, and we're starting to see a bit of a changeover in the last few weeks, where the summer local birds were flocking up. We started to see some movements of birds coming down from up north. And at this point, quite a few of them have departed and essentially been replaced with some of the later migrants. So this is a really a good time of that transition as birds are moving through in sequence.
Yeah. What are your favorite places to bird watch?
Well, probably my most
in
favorite.
The fall.
My most favorite is right in my own backyard.
Yeah.
It's very convenient. I live in the northern Kettle Moraine, so that's a good place to keep a watch on. And over to the Lake Michigan is certainly a great spot for a migratory corridor. And, of course, picking up some of the birds out on the open water. Horicon Marsh, where I worked for so many years, is a major stopover for an awful lot of birds. And, you know, you can go almost anywhere within Wisconsin and find a good spot where birds are both nesting in summer and stopping over at this time of the year.
Yeah, just was in the La Crosse area a few weeks back, and that Mississippi River is...
It's a highway.
It is a highway indeed, and I was up there one fall for some bird watching on the river, and it was unbelievable. The thousands and thousands of birds that were out there on the water.
Yeah, if you can get to some of these places at the right time of the year, you can find some very large flocks. I came across Horicon Marsh on my way down this morning, and lots of ducks were out feeding in the water there. And these are birds that are stopping over at this point. So when we're talking migration, we will have that preparation for migration where the local birds are done raising the young. They'll start to flock and gather. And then also now when birds are in transit, the birds will be coming down to your locale, and then they'll rest for a while, feed and flock. So when we think about actual migration, we usually don't see most of the birds really flying in migration. We see them more stopping over and gathering in flocks to refuel and rest, because most of the migration, especially for songbirds, takes place at night.
Yeah.
So you don't see that. And even for large birds like Canada geese and cranes, there's a lot of movement, but this is oftentimes when they've settled down. And the actual migration, the birds are just way up there, and it'd be something that you would see for less than 1 minute as they're passing overhead. So I had always told people, if you're looking at Canada geese, if you see them flying from 1 to 500 feet up, those are local feeding flights. They're just going from where they rested during the day out to feed and then come back again for the evening. In migration, they'll be up 2 to 5,000 feet, and we've seen them over 10,000 feet, and they're looking for favorable winds. So these birds are going to be way up there. And if you see a flock of birds heading south with a good wind and up against the clouds, that's true migration.
And you call it one of the greatest phenomena among the animal world.
To me, it certainly is. This coming and going of massive numbers of birds as they travel with the seasons. Just the journeys that some of these birds make is just amazing. For anybody who spends time in nature, it is just a wonderful way to gauge the changing seasons as the different birds arrive and as they leave again. And the fact that some of these birds are making incredible flights, especially among the sandpipers, they're making flights of 8 to 10,000 miles each way. And with recent technology that we've been able to employ for studying birds, and some of the new information that we're gathering, we're realizing that some of these birds are capable of making some of these flights almost nonstop.
That is absolutely amazing to me. And there's been so much research on migration and birds, but what don't we know about migration? In other words, are there some mysteries that still remain there?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's what makes it so interesting is that we know more today than ever, of course, but there's still a lot of things that we don't understand. A couple of things that have been recently revealed among bird populations is that not only do birds go back to the same place, of course, where there's nesting in summer, but also in wintertime. But what we've also found is that for large populations of birds that, say, nest across the eastern United States, and I was working with some people who did studies on wood thrushes, and what they found there is that wood thrushes from Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Quebec are going down to northern Nicaragua. The birds from the of Illinois, Wisconsin, Tennessee, they're going down to Belize. The ones from New England are going to Costa Rica. So they're not just going south, but distinctive regional populations are going down to very distinctive regions. And so we think this probably holds true for a lot of birds, but certainly not all. There's always exceptions. The other mystery is for shorebirds, for example, the adults depart from the nesting ground before the young, and somehow they know where to go. They're, in a sense, almost born with a knowledge and a map. And we are also understand more and more about bird navigation. We know some of the environmental cues that they rely on. So in order to get from point A to point B and do so unerringly year after year throughout the life of that bird, we certainly know that they are looking for favorable winds. And so last night we had a nice north wind come through, a little gusty, I think, for some songbirds. But that's what you want is a nice boost and a push to move you south. So you get a north wind behind you. You're going generally in the right direction. You mentioned the Mississippi River, the birds that are moving there. They're using the geographical features. So the north-south features, the Atlantic coast, Pacific, the Rocky Mountain Range, Mississippi, even the Lake Michigan shoreline, these are all geographical features. Flying at night, it was discovered back in the 1970s that birds use stellar navigation. Problem is when the clouds roll in, what happens there when they can't see the stars? What's the fallback system there? And we think there's multiple cues, of course, they're using. We also know that some birds are very sensitive to electromagnetic fields. And this was a study done back in the 50s. They took homing pigeons from New York, traveled down to Virginia, and they'd never been there before. Before releasing them, they put a little bit of a magnet on the tops of heads of some of the pigeons, and to make sure it wasn't just having weight on your head, they put brass plates on the others. The guys with the brass plates made it home. The others apparently were just circling around out there for forever, so this seemed to interfere with navigation. Another interesting phenomenon for Wisconsin birds is, you know, we've been reintroducing the whooping cranes into Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And they actually have learning involved in the migration. So the parents have to teach the young, which is why Operation Migration, the ultralight airplane, was a substitute to show the first ones the route. All you got to do is teach them to go south, and they seem to remember where to come back coming north. But we did have a few birds that were, of course, we know the individuals since they're tagged.
Yeah.
They got off course, and one showed up in South Dakota, one Michigan, one in Connecticut. But interestingly, they're all at the same latitude. They knew how far north to go, and perhaps that's electromagnetic fields there, but had to learn the actual route to get back to central Wisconsin. So probably also other birds among the different families of birds rely on different cues, have different habits. They don't all do the same thing in terms of how they get from place to place. They've all learned it or are instinctively born with some other skills. But unerringly, they all migrate one way or another. And we're trying to figure out just how some of them do it. What are the exceptions and what are some unique traits? And it just is endless study. And it's just, as I say, a continuing mystery, but it's just fun to watch. And people have been doing it for thousands of years.
Dan, who's near Hayward, has a question for you. Let's go there.
Yeah, please.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, how you doing? I got a question. It's not so much about the migration, but I got blue jays that are just tearing up my apple trees, and I don't know what to do about it. Any suggestions?
So
they're hitting the fruit?
Are they eating the fruit? Is that it, Dan?
Yeah, I went out of town about 3 weeks ago for 2 days. I had a crab apple tree that had probably several hundred apples on, and I came home and it was completely cleaned out like somebody plucked them. It was amazing. And I don't know how to keep these birds out of my trees. They just come in and they just destroy them and they leave. They come in the morning in flocks. Mm-hmm. Blue jays.
Blue jays do. That's an unusual diet for a blue jay, but they're such a generalist. Almost anything's on the menu for them. As we get into wintertime, those fruits that remain, robins and cedar waxwings will commonly take the dried up crab apples. That's a common food. This is unusual for blue jays. I suppose about the only thing you do is sort of the scarecrow thing, one way or another, deter them. But you've got to be as persistent as the birds themselves. And, you know, it's just like a bird that's tapping on the windows, that's seeing its shadow. You can get out in the morning, you try to distract it, and you have to go to work all day. Well, you know, the birds have just got this whole day then for developing bad habits. That's a difficult one, and I'm sorry, I really can't offer a good solution except some sort of deterrent, and some, if you can find some way to scare them away, to be as persistent as the birds.
Yeah.
But, of course, they're protected under the federal laws, so you cannot harm the birds themselves.
No. Netting, maybe, if you've got small
trees. You can try
trees.
Netting, yes. There is fruit netting that does work. Of course, trying to put it over the whole tree is one thing. The problem I have with that is oftentimes birds get tangled in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't want to create a bit of a death trap just to try to prohibit the birds from having access.
Mm-hmm. Dan, there you go. Thank you for calling. Judy in Central Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'm wondering about the kind of birds that I saw yesterday evening around 6 o'clock, and they were in two elm trees, and they were obviously all gathered there for a migration because they were all talking to each other and the tree was just full. And they were, I didn't see them, although they did fly from one tree to the other. I'm just wondering what sort of bird might be.
Well, this time of year, probably a large list of things. The blackbirds, both red-winged blackbird and grackles, are gathering in some large flocks right now.
Yeah.
Cedar waxwings is another one that's flocking in pretty good numbers. And some of these birds can be extremely vocal. The blackbirds won't migrate till much later in the year, so what you're really seeing is coming into an evening roost site after scattering across the countryside and feeding for the day. At some later point in the year, those birds will take off with the north winds. Waxwings, they can even remain through the wintertime if there's food. But, yeah, as far as which bird, you know, it's a lot of them that have a similar habit. Like,
especially if we don't have an idea of what they look like.
Yeah. Some birds tend to be a little bit more solitary in their habits. So quite a few of the songbirds do not gather in trees like that in extreme large numbers. But I would say the blackbirds, probably blackbirds, grackles,
one of those
the
two.
Most likely ones that are extremely visible.
Yeah, I would think so. Judy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, our guest, talking birds and birding with him, and I hope you'll join in. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking birds and birding on the show today with our guest, Bill Volkert, a retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Always great to have Bill come by. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Jeff in Berry Mills has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. I just wanted to, or good afternoon, I just wanted to throw in a little aside in here that right before your program came on, the National Weather Service in La Crosse posted a picture of on their radar of at sunrise this morning, several large flocks of birds taking off from southern Minnesota and northern Iowa. Pretty cool.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, one of the things when they developed Doppler radar was that they kept getting this backscatter at certain times of the year in signals when all the other predictive models were saying that there was no precipitation. And they weren't quite sure what it was, the interference. And eventually I realized that this was the migration of birds. And so Doppler radar has become a nice way of tracking migration. And as we mentioned earlier, we had a cold front come through last night.
Yeah.
And with that, the wind shifted out of the north. I think most people felt that. And to me, it seemed a little gusty down by the house. But as you get up a couple hundred feet, you know, if you have nice steady winds, those are the ideal conditions for bird migration. And radar certainly does reveal to us that we can have these movements of tens of thousands of birds. We don't know what kind they are from the radar, but we get an idea of just general density, which they can kind of extrapolate into rough numbers of birds that are flying. And yeah, you get these massive movements. The other thing they're doing is they're using microphones, pointing those up to the sky. And with the computer capability, using that, just like your Merlin app, to identify the call notes of the birds going over. So, in other words, radar will tell us that we've got large numbers of birds and some relative numbers of what's going on up there. And then with the microphones, we get an idea of who's making up those flocks and flying through. And again, all this new technology is giving us insights into birds and bird migration in a way like never before. And some of the findings that we have are just within the last 5-10 years, and it just keeps evolving.
Randy in La Crosse will give you a chance. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to talk about, I grew up in Minnesota, and there's the Sherburne Wildlife Area in kind of central Minnesota along towards the river. And sandhill cranes gather there every fall, like huge numbers of them. And those cranes, when they gather, or after they've gathered, then they migrate and they go to a big lake in Nebraska, which I've been to also, and that's even more amazing. But there's another group that gathers near Grantsburg.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I've been able to hear, or from what I tried to look into it, those birds go to Florida.
Correct.
The birds in Minnesota end up going to Texas. And I'm like, these gathering places are so close together. How do they separate that? How do they keep track of it?
Good question. Well, we talked earlier that the cranes are teaching their young. So cranes do not begin to nest or select a mate until they're at least 4 years old. So there is that period where they're non-breeders, and Canada geese also 2 to 3 years old before they start to nest. So the first year they're following their parents to the wintering grounds, follow them back up, and then they just sort of hang out as non-breeders. They'll join back in on those large flocks, and from that, they're learning that whole route and teaching their young. Now, the reason for the difference in the cranes is that you're looking at two different populations. The ones that are going to Nebraska and then down toward Texas are a little bit smaller. That's the lesser sandhill crane. It's a different subspecies. And here, Wisconsin, the upper Midwest, Michigan, this is the greater sandhill crane. Yeah, they're going down toward Georgia, North Florida. And we also have birds, depending on mild winters, may only go to Kentucky, Tennessee, southern Illinois. So wherever they need to go. So tradition takes them much farther south. And some of the birds always go to those wintering grounds. Others will just go as far as they have to. And we see the same thing with Canada geese, where the first migrants always arrive about mid-September. They're coming down from Hudson Bay, James Bay. They come into central Wisconsin. And yet we don't reach peak until mid to late October, when we finally get the first snow and ice in Canada, when they're forced off of those summer grounds. So there's some of them that seem to go by a signal of the shortening day length and anticipate migrations coming up. And we don't know if it's always the same ones, if that's passed on, if it's genetic or learned, and yet others will delay as long as they can. And then the same thing, where some of them will always go to the traditional wintering ground, continue all the way south, and others will linger until the snow accumulation forces them to go a little farther. So there's a little bit of different habit among the very same flock of either cranes or Canada geese.
Peggy in Black Earth will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. My question is this. I heard you mention that some cedar waxwings will stay through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
We live on hardwood acreage in the woods, and I'm wondering, is there something I can put out to encourage them to stay around for food?
Oh, yes. Well, the cedar waxwings, they're catching insects during the summertime. You'll see them along lake shores and rivers in particular, hawking the insects, so flying up from a perch and grabbing them out of the air. And as we get into fall and winter, they're shifting their diet over to berries. And so berries is a big part of their winter food. And so the crab apples and other wild berries are a major food source for them. And it depends if we get a good berry-producing crop in a single year and how long that persists. So in wintertime, they become nomads. They move around wherever they can find that food. We pick flocks of cedar waxwings up on Christmas bird counts in Wisconsin every year. The numbers depends a little bit. It seems that as that food dwindles, as we get into that mid-late winter, they start to move further south. And then we see the return of them again coming back in May.
In May. There you go, Peggy. Thank you. So she has some crabapple trees or some berries?
Exactly. Fruit trees would be the main thing. Something with a medium-sized fruit would be the best thing to provide for them. One of the problems that we find is that for birds that are eating a lot of berries, the invasive buckthorn is a real problem because their digestive system doesn't handle it real well. So here, it looks like a good food source for them, but what we found is that for some of these birds, it's actually a diuretic, and so that with that, they're actually the food's running through them very quickly, and now at this time of year when they should be gaining weight, they're not doing so. And so there's another problem with these invasives, with the non-natives, is that simply that our insects that depend on those plants and even the birds that do are just not adapted because it's basically a completely foreign type of plant for them, and they just have never adapted well to it.
Yeah, Peggy, thank you. To go along with that, Colleen from New Holstein emailed. She actually takes her bird feeders down on Father's Day because there's plenty of food around for the birds. But when should she put her bird seed feeders up? Are there specific telltale signs to look for before hanging them?
Oh, whenever you have time and have interest. We've mentioned this in the past that even in most winter times, we find that birds that come to feeders are still getting the vast majority of their food from the wild. It's just a convenience for them. So we're really feeding birds more for ourselves than we are for them. No doubt if we get a severe winter storm, it can be a lifeline for some of those birds. You can feed year-round, as the person had mentioned here. Yeah, summertime, there's so much food, it's hard to attract them necessarily. But I feed during the summertime. It's enjoyable to see the young coming to the feeders. Of course, during that time, you've just got to clean the feeders and change the food more often because you can have spoilage, and that's always important for it. There's also been a myth of keeping hummingbird feeders up too late, that we keep the hummingbirds here, that they won't migrate if we keep the feeders out. That's not true. They'll know when to go on their own, whether there's food or not. In fact, it may be the food that they need, right, as this time of year, as flowers are becoming less common and the food supply is starting to dwindle for those that have lingered.
And speaking of hummingbirds, Jeffrey in Green Lake's got something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hello. Hi. I was wondering if your guest has ever heard or seen a pure white hummingbird.
I have seen pictures of them. The albino can show up in most any kind of animal and bird. There are obviously some of the birds that show that much more commonly. Either partial albinism, where just a few of the feathers or the head or something is going to be white, where they have that piebald mixed color, or pure white, total albino, where they just have no pigments. It's obviously a rare genetic a combination for them. It can show up in small numbers in any population. But hummingbirds, I've seen a few photos of it. It's certainly extremely rare out there and very unique, no doubt.
Yeah. Jeffrey, did you see one?
My daughter did just outside her apartment in Green Lake, and she took a video of it.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, that is a rare sight.
Yeah, very rare. Thanks for sharing that, Jeffrey. Appreciate it. Daryl in Bangor, we'll go to you now. Hi, Daryl.
Well, good morning, Larry. How are you today?
Just doing great. What's on your mind?
Well, I was amazed at your topic because each year at about this time, I check on the Raptor Resource Project, and it has the Mississippi River Flyway Cam, where you can watch the birds right on the Mississippi, and I have my computer screen up right now, and it's amazing the different kinds of birds that you see. My question is, it just seems like pelicans. There's so many more pelicans than I remember growing up. And is that just we're just lucky, or what's happening with the pelicans?
Well, there's actually been an eastward shift in the pelican population. And it started back in the mid to late 90s. There was a kind of the result of an extended drought in these central prairie states where most of the pelicans actually nest. And there was a very large colony of some 30,000 birds out on Chase Lake. And they were pretty isolated, no shallow wetland areas, except for when the drought came, the coyotes had access to it. So that became a pretty dangerous situation, and those birds began to abandon some of those sites, and we started seeing them setting up a little bit further to the east. And we had the first nesting in Wisconsin in 1996, and then little by little, we had nesting colonies that were becoming established. Pelican is another one of these very long-lived birds where the young birds will not begin to mate until they're probably around 5 or 6 years old. So you'll oftentimes see some large flocks in summertime of just these non-breeders gathered out there roosting and fishing on some of the lakes. And then you'll have the nesting colonies punctuated across the state. And for the last about 20 years, they've been well-established here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, really interesting. Daryl, thank you so much for calling. Greg in Hazelhurst says they've seen a pair of red-headed woodpeckers on their property for 5 years, usually stay until late fall or early winter, and sometimes stay through the winter.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, this last summer they disappeared, and wonders what happens. Did they lose their food source? Or, I mean, 5 years for a red-headed woodpecker.
Well, the red-headed woodpecker population across most of the state in general is quite low.
Yes.
So you do hear reports in the eastern and in the north-central part of the Wisconsin. The western and southwest part of the state is really the stronghold where we still have a fairly stable population. So people in these outlying areas will have a pair or two reported here and there. And I wonder if perhaps something happened to one of the pair or even both of them and essentially lost the entire local population because there was just, you know, that one pair that was nesting in the area. I guess the only thing to do is watch for next year, see if something shows up. If they have been successful in raising young over those 5 years, perhaps some of those young might have a tradition and come back again. You know, there's always that turnover among the population, too. A lot of these birds are living just 3-5 years, 7 to 8 years maybe. For a lot of the smaller birds, living 10 to 12 years is probably extended. Anything over 12 years is like you and I living over 100.
Yeah.
Maybe you'd want to, but it's not going to happen
gonna
for
happen.
Most of us. So with that, you have this turnover, and as we're watching birds, you need to have a pretty stable population that's recruiting or reproducing young to take and replace those birds as they disappear. And when they start to get smaller in numbers like that, when it's one of your only pair in the neighborhood, if they disappear, you may not have something to draw from to be able to take their place.
Mm-hmm.
But keep watching. We'll see what happens.
See what happens. And the caller before had mentioned raptors.
Mm-hmm.
And tomorrow on the show, I just wanted to mention Greg Septim.
Oh, yes.
Will be with us. You know, he founded the Wisconsin Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project, and so, you know, he's been doing that for 27 years, and it'll be fun to talk with him about peregrine
falcon.
Do
say hi. I haven't seen him in quite a while, but I've known Greg for many years.
Yeah, a great guy. You can join in, too. Questions, give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Wanted to highlight a few birds today on the show, one of them, the catbird. We have a few bird songs and calls to play, and the first is the gray catbird, and here's let's play that song.
Mm-hmm. That's the summer song. He's a very chatty bird. It's that back and forth. It's just may go on for 15-20 seconds. And he'll throw occasionally in that little meow. And that's really the call note that we're hearing more this time of year. And this is a bird that loves the thickets. They'll nest in the heavy shrubbery, just like cardinals. So especially right now, they may be feeding on the berries of the bushes. They'll be hiding in those shrubs, and they're more easily heard. and I've got them around my property. I can hear them in the thickets and in the shrubs with that little meow call. And another interesting call I only hear at this time of year, and I think it's perhaps the young ones, to me it sounds like Jerry. Everybody tries to put their own little verse or phrasing to remember the bird calls. But it is interesting that it tends to be more in late summer and fall that I hear that particular call only.
Hmm.
But that's a bird that is fairly vocal, and they'll be departing within the next couple of weeks, heading down toward mostly into Mexico and the central part of Central America.
Another bird we're featuring today is the white-throated sparrow. And
old Sam Peabody, 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 or Oh Sweet Canada, Canada, Canada. That's a little mnemonic, yeah. Remember. It's that high, thin whistle, and you will occasionally hear some of the birds producing that song in the fall time. Otherwise, it's just a single, real sharp chip note. This is another bird that loves the undergrowth and the brush and thickets, nesting in northern Wisconsin and southern Canada in the bogs, and now coming through, and they may be anywhere where there's some undergrowth and some heavy shrubs and cover. And interesting that the birds are not mating at this time of year, but you'll occasionally hear them produce a song. A couple of thoughts on that. One is that you're seeing a lot of physiological changes in the birds for migration, and these are hormone changes for the birds. They're molting their feathers. They're accumulating fat. They're getting into what is called a pre-migratory restlessness. They're just getting jumpy and ready to go. They know that they've got to be heading out. There's some actual physiological changes going on, and perhaps that same hormone change is also producing a song occasionally, which they won't need until spring. The other thought is these could be young ones that are practicing that song. They've heard it in the summer. They're going to try that little bit, make sure they get it right, so that next year they'll have a song and a chance for a mate. They also took white-throated sparrows years ago and captured them, kept them in a laboratory, took them out of the nest when they were very young to try to understand about song development. And what they found was they have the physical ability to produce the voice, but they have to learn the specific song. And so they refine that. Then this is perhaps that communication between each other. How am I doing? You know, how am I sounding? Trying and practicing a bit. And that's why as you go across the country, for some birds that have very large, widespread populations like song sparrows, they sing differently in different parts of the country. There are actual dialects. Because they're learning a little bit of a different song from the others in the neighborhood.
That is amazing. Warblers, according to the Cornell Lab website, the yellow-rumped warbler can be found almost anywhere on the North American continent. Let's listen to that call. Lee's got it.
This is the call note. Because this time of year, they're not going to be singing. And it's a bird that I can pick out by its call very easily. It somehow, I learned that many years ago, and it just catches my ear. It's not a sharp chip like a sparrow would be. It's not, we would describe perhaps as metallic like a cardinal. It's a little more sputtered. And it's hard to define, really. But if you listen to it enough, it's very distinct, very characteristic. And there is that difference between songs and calls. Mm-hmm. And basically, song is what the males are producing in springtime when they're establishing a territory to keep other males out and to lure a mate. And that's usually the more complicated, more complex vocalization. Calls are given throughout the year. And they may be when birds are flying overhead in migration, contact calls. It may be for food, if they're finding food source. Some birds, especially with birds that tend to flock more, rely on each other. A lot more communication. So birds like chickadees and blue jays have just a very large vocabulary. And we'll hear a variety of different calls among them. And, of course, there's also calls for danger. So when they see predators, I remember one year I could actually hear birds with that real sharp little call note that they're making for predator. It really caught my ear, and it was kind of going across the forest. I heard three, four birds that were giving it one after another from different areas. And as I glanced up, all of a sudden a Cooper's hawk came through. They had spotted him before I did. And basically one after another was out there, hawk, another one, hawk. And everybody just buried themselves in the thickets and then got down and just froze, hoping that they weren't going to give themselves away. So we also find for chickadees that they have all clear signal when the danger is past. So there's a real complex kind of vocalization among some of these birds. Some are very simple. Some have much more of a vocabulary or a vocal repertoire.
Yeah, really cool. Bob in Sun Prairie, your turn. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, I got two comments. I was down in Paducah, Kentucky about 10 years ago and walking down the sidewalk of the downtown area, and I could hear somebody's phone ringing. And I thought, whose phone is ringing? And this gal came out of a storefront there and told me it was a mockingbird. And that mockingbird was literally making the exact sound of a telephone ringing.
Thus the name, yes.
Very cool.
Unbelievable. But my other question was, when I travel west on Interstate 80, when I get out in western Nebraska by the Platte River, I often witness huge migrations of birds. And this last year, it happened to be snow geese, and they were on both sides of the road. I was so amazed. I got off the interstate and took some pictures. And I was wondering, I don't know, how do you estimate how many birds are there?
Okay, I'll take that one first. A couple of ways to be able to count birds. For geese, the problem is when you're looking straight across of them in the field, they're sort of almost on top of each other, so it's hard to separate individuals. When we do our surveys of geese, we do it by airplane. It's easy because you're looking straight down at it. And people have also tried to count shorebird numbers, the sandpipers along the Atlantic coast, for example, when they're stopping over and you get these massive flocks going back and forth. A couple of different ways to do it. Most of it is what we call group counting. So I used to do this at Horicon when we'd see flocks of geese coming in and try to give an estimate. Because I remember people coming, I'm going, oh, gosh, I was here years ago and I saw so many geese. There must have been millions. It's, well, that's not anywhere near accurate. So for science, we need to be somewhat, have a good guess anyways. And for a group count, what you want to do is if you count out actual off to the side of a flock, try to count 10 birds or even 25. I like to start with visualizing. I can get a pretty good just visualization of 25 birds by looking at them enough. Mm-hmm. So you go, okay, if that's 25 right there, 50, 75, that's 100. Kind of draw a little circle around that visually. Okay, that's 100, 2, 3, 4, 500 right there. Double that, that's 1,000, 2, 3, 4, 5,000. And you just kind of rough estimate, and it gets you in the ballpark. And remember, when we're talking for science, if we're trying to do population estimates or anything else we're counting in nature, you want to, for statistical significance, be within a 95 percentile. In other words, you want to be within 5%, give or take some. So in other words, when we're talking about a flock of 100,000 Canada geese at Horicon Marsh, I mean, you can be off by 5,000 either way and still be close enough. And it's certainly better than must have been millions. So it is estimates. And another thing that was interesting for shorebirds is I actually saw some videos where they've got flocks of birds going back and forth. They give you 3 to 5 seconds to look at it. And then you type in your numbers. And what they've done is they actually, by using a computer digitally, count the exact number there. And you train your eye to get a little closer and closer to it. One other little aside, a fellow who I used to work with who actually did the Canada goose counting at Horicon Marsh by plane. These were weekly surveys. He went to the grocery store and he bought himself bags and bags of little beans. And he had a jar of exactly 1,000 beans. And he would start in fall time and spread those out on the paper. And he'd spread them way out. He'd bunch them real close together. And he just trained his eye to see what does 1,000 look like. When you're 500 feet up, those little geese from there, they look like beans. And at least he had some sort of a visual cue to go by.
Interesting. Very interesting. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking birds and birding with our guest, Bill Volkert. Great to have him back, and thank you for joining in. Vivian in Green Bay called but couldn't stay with us. She's wondering which birds are legal to keep if you find them dead.
The only ones you can actually keep are game birds.
Mm-hmm.
So all birds are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and that was signed between U.S. and Canada in 1917 and 1928 with Mexico. So basically it says that you cannot harm any birds, you cannot possess any wild birds or any part thereof, so you cannot even keep a feather collection. What happens technically is when we have a duck hunting season, they basically put that season in the Federal Registry each year, and as a legal sense, that is an exemption to the Migratory Bird Treaty Act that says that this year, during this period, we can actually shoot and harvest these birds at this rate. Also, turkeys, you'll see quite a bit of the arts and crafts turkey feathers are being used these days because it is a game bird. So in other words, for mounted birds, if you have a collection of mounted birds, personally, it can only be game birds that have been gotten from the wild. If you have a collector's permit, which is given not to an individual but to an institution, those are museums, schools, nature centers, so they can have hawks, owls, eagles, well, not eagles so much, but different birds like that that they have a special permit for, which allows them as, again, licensed under the federal protection laws. The only other ones that do not fall under that Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and this was, I believe it was in 2006, was Congress passed the Migratory Treaty Reform Act, and that basically said that the non-native birds, the exotics that we have in the United States, are exempt from that. So there were some people who were trying to sue the state of Florida for trying to reduce and get rid of the purple swamp hen, which was brought over from Africa. It was competing with the gallinules down there in the marshes. And finally, Congress said, well, we're not going to protect those birds because they don't belong here in the first place. They were not native birds. So I guess you could, if you want to possess a starling, you could.
So Earl emailed us, 50 years ago, it was common for people to travel hours to see migrating geese at Horican Refuge. And mm-hmm. today, geese are commonplace in many areas throughout the summer. Can you explain the change, Earl wants?
Yeah, well, they've kind of worn out their welcome, I guess. When Canada geese were seen primarily in migration at places like Horicon Marsh in those extraordinary numbers, it was a unique phenomenon. And if anybody has not been there for the late fall migration of geese, it still is a unique
Amazing.
Phenomenon.
Amazing.
I used to have people come to the marsh going, ugh, geese, I'm sick of them. I got that many at home. Well, you're nowhere near what Horicon Marsh will harbor during the peak of the migration. What's really happened is we have two subspecies of the Canada goose. The migratory flock coming from Hudson Bay, James Bay, stopping in Wisconsin, going down towards southern Illinois. That comprises the big migratory flock. And then the birds we see here all summer, which is the giant Canada goose. Their population has been increasing, so we're seeing geese throughout the entire summer period now. And that's why these birds are so widespread. They're causing conflicts, of course, when they're in the city parks and on golf courses, places like that. And so this is what I mean by wearing out their welcome. They're coming into somewhat conflict with people during that summer recreation period. They're trying to raise families in the same places we want to use for our own fun. And so I guess some people just don't see them as quite the unique phenomenon that they used to be. But I can tell you that having worked at Horicon Marsh, when I hear a large flock overhead, it always catches my ear. There's something unique, and it is a real sign of the season.
It is indeed. Amy in Ellison Bay has something kind of relates in a way. Let's go there. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just looking for a little guidance. If I had just one weekend to take a camping trip and I was interested in seeing migrating birds, would you more recommend that I do go to the Horican Marsh or make my way to the Mississippi River, in which case I don't know exactly where to go?
Well, the Mississippi River is a large corridor, and there's only so many public properties and overlooks where you can access the river. And some of those may or may not be large staging areas for the birds. So you can go up and down the river, and some, you know, they're going to be punctuated where the large flocks are going to gather. Horik on Mars is probably a little bit easier because it is one single property. It is 13 miles long, but there are a number of great access points and overlooks where you can stand. I'll tell you, for Canada geese, the biggest mistake most people make is they tend to take their time, show up around 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, hang out, have a little bit of lunch, and then be heading home before dark. And they miss the flock time and again because they come in at sunset. So you want to remain right in that last time from about 4 o'clock till 6 p.m. That's when the big flocks come into the marsh. And we usually reach peak of Canada geese as we get into mid-late October. Right now, ducks are building up in big numbers, and also songbirds are gathering on the marsh.
Yeah, so get over there in the afternoon, and you'll see a lot of birds, but stay.
Yeah, if you're looking for the geese, for the big migration or the big flights of them, that's at sunset because they're out feeding during the day.
Yeah, there you go, Amy. Thank
but there's a lot of other birds to be seen on the marsh. So the ducks remain there, of course, and they're gathered up right now at some good numbers.
Dave in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, I really liked Amy's question. My question is, I wanted to find out about feral cats, what effect they have. And what are the predators for feral cats? I watched a Dirty Job show the other night, and it showed a group that captures feral cats, neuters them, and then releases them back into the wild. And I wanted to get his opinion on that.
Quick opinion on that, which is capture, neuter, release, bad idea. Sure, you're not going to reproduce, but you still have a predator out there that does not belong here. It is a non-native predator. It is basically, in my mind, an invasive species, especially for ferals, and birds have no defense against that. The Canadian Wildlife Service has actually determined that feral cats, and these are either pets that are left outside or those that are roaming wild, they are the number one human-caused mortality for songbirds in Canada.
Wow.
So it is a significant impact. And the world's just basically getting more dangerous for birds. We're reducing the amount of habitat where they can even live, whether that's where they winter down in the tropics or coming here to nest and raise young. Also in between, the stopover places where they have safe refuge to rest, feed, refuel, and have sufficient food sources for them. That's making the journey harder for them. We've got our tall structures that they fly into, whether that's Chicago last year, the McCormick Center. All of our skyscrapers, buildings are all possible obstructions for these birds, and those are all lethal hazards. Communication towers, our large picture windows, the cats, we're just adding up with more and more things that make it difficult for birds and more challenging for them. So anything we can do to try to reduce that, any one of those impacts is certainly going to help. Because, I mean, these birds have been here with us for so long, and they have a place in nature. We've just basically got to give them that place that they need and make it safe for them.
Yeah. And bird strikes on windows, I just see now that they're saying that the mortality is much higher than was originally expected. That it's
well, one of the things that a lot of people tell me is, oh, a bird flew in my window. He didn't kill himself, so I put him in a paper bag. He rested for a little bit. I heard him fluttering. I turned him loose. He flew away, so I think he was okay. The problem is we don't know what sort of internal injuries they may have suffered. So they either fly in and break their neck and die immediately, or they may end up with some internal bleeding and something so they can fly away, but they don't survive. That is probably the easiest thing that we can do to resolve. And I did this at my home. And essentially for songbirds, they try not to fly through anything that is 4 inches apart or less, because they don't think they can fit. And all I did was just get some little adhesive strips, put them on my windows, and that provides a visual barrier. My window strikes went from about 10 or 12 a year to almost absolutely zero. The ones that do hit these days, they're already slowing down and just barely tap it. A lot of things to consider out there for us to help birds.
Bill, thank you so much. We'll look forward to another visit. Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, our guest. Big thanks to our whole team, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our producers, our tech directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots in store here on WPR News.